Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Sam Lipsyte about Nicholson Baker's raunchy new novel.
As I mentioned in the review, it's sort of built on a porn film structure. So we get episodes in each chapter, and most of them build to a climax. And throughout, there's really raunchy sex. Yeah.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Deborah Solomon discusses the long correspondence between Georgia O'Keeffe and Alfred Stieglitz.
I do think a reviewer should read the book, so I did read all the letters. And they do, on the plus side, remind you that letters are probably the most vivid way to access the dead.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. Nicholson Baker is one of America's most enterprising and accomplished novelists. He's got a new book, quite controversial, called House of Holes, A Book of Raunch. It's reviewed for us by another superb novelist, Sam Lipsyte, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Sam.
Thank you.
All right, we've got your review on the cover of the book review, and there are holes and slightly suggestive images in our decorative cover. This book is like totally filthy, right?
Oh, absolutely. As I mentioned in the review, it sort of is built on a porn film structure. So we get episodes in each chapter, and most of them build to a climax. And throughout, there's really raunchy sex, yeah.
Is it fun to read?
Yeah, it is a lot of fun to read if you're somebody who likes to read raunch.
And it's not like your – what we used to call – I'm dating myself, sort of dime store raunch. I mean, Baker's a real writer and a tremendously inventive one.
Absolutely, but he's also having a lot of fun with that dime store form. One of the things he does that's so wonderful is he kind of maintains the structure of a chapter in a raunch book, but plays with syntax and diction in such ways that the prose itself, while maintaining the silliness of some of that traditional raunch, it also becomes a kind of mad poetry as well.
And is it, how should we say, stimulating at all?
You know, that's a very embarrassing question, but yes, I found a lot of it very stimulating.
Some of our listeners will remember that this is not by any means Nicholson Baker's first foray into the realm of very sexual writing. In fact, he became kind of a celebrity during the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky years because of his novel Vox, which one or the other had given as a present. Was
it
Monica?
Monica gave it to Bill, I'm pretty sure.
So this is a subject he's really interested in, Baker. Has he done something this time around he didn't do before?
I think it's a little different because Vox and the book that came after, The Fermata, if you remember that, were both raunchy books or maybe books filled with sex and talking about sex. But they weren't necessarily going the total free-for-all that this book is. This book sort of makes you seek out any other meanings, any deeper themes, and they're there, and they can be linked, and interesting things are happening besides just the play of parts, let's say. But I think those books were more sort of urgently trying to make a point about the way we live, whereas this is almost this kind of escape that turns out, if you think about it, to not truly be an escape.
Sam, you've said that the novel imitates or parodies a kind of raunchy, sleazy sex novel. Is there a story that's being told? Is there a plot with recognizable characters?
Well, there's a setting. The setting is really one of the strongest aspects of the novel. And it's this place, the House of Holes, where people come and they always arrive in a very odd way through some sort of hole, usually a very tiny hole. It could be through a straw. It could be through a coffee cup. And suddenly they arrive at the House of Holes, and it's kind of a nice compound with lots of buildings and grassy areas and some forest and a lake, and it looks like a spa. And people come, and the thing that's funny about it is that it's also quite expensive to go there unless you have some sort of scholarship or work-study deal with them. And so as these characters seem to be cavorting, you also understand that they're draining their bank accounts and perhaps ruining their futures. But in terms of plot, we do have several characters that keep returning, including a severed arm called Dave's arm. Dave's arm is actually one of the more vibrant characters in the book. And we see them in various places at the House of Holes. And they have little arcs, you could say, but it's not really the kind of book where you're looking for deep psychological change or recognition or anything like that.
Sam, your novel, The Ask, which got spectacular reviews, including here in the book review, is extremely funny. How many novelists – you don't have to name names. Baker is probably one of them. Do you find really amusing? Or when you're reading them, do you think, okay, he did that stunt. I know that stunt too. He's doing this thing and sometimes I do that. Do you know what I mean? Is it very clinical for you or can somebody really make you laugh?
Well, there are a few people that I will just give up those critical approaches to and just go along for the ride because I know they are masters and I will laugh. And they're great novelists who happen to be incredibly funny. But often, yeah, well, you know, they say dying is easy, comedy is hard. It's a very difficult thing to do, and it's different from making people laugh in person or on stage. It's a different craft.
Yeah, what is it exactly? Do you have to imagine the response of the reader? Is it timing?
It's timing, but it's not the same timing necessarily that you would get from a stand-up comedian. It's a similar performance. But it's slightly different, and I haven't figured it out. Someday I will completely figure it out, I hope.
Do you watch other kinds of humor? Like, are you a fan of stand-up?
I'm a big fan of stand-up comedy, absolutely. And, you know, some of the really brilliant, funny people out there right now are doing comedy on television or in stand-up or on the radio. I'm thinking of, you know, somebody like Louis C.K., say, or the podcasts of Marc Maron. I mean, these are people that are seasoned stand-ups who are now being really funny in other mediums. But the point is there's something about being funny on the page that requires such attention not only to the timing but to the rhythm, to the cadence, to the syntax, to the diction, all the things that we more associate with poets caring about perhaps. But a lot of fiction writers just kind of barrel right through with their prose that's fine and may have a nice turn of phrase here and there and be a little lyrical here. But they're just trying to get the story out. There may be tragicomic elements of it, but it's not quite the precision funniness of certain novelists.
A thing we talk about here sometimes in the office is I'm really suspicious of the expression laugh out loud funny because I read very little that actually physically makes me laugh. Every now and again, Philip Roth will. Something will just pile on in such an absurd way. Or it might just be a single word that's brought in at an unexpected time. And then I'm collapsing with laughter. And I wonder, does he know that's the effect he's going to have? Are you able to guess at the effects your work will have?
Yeah, I mean you're hoping that's the effect it will have. I mean I think somebody like Philip Roth is obviously aware. And often it is just about a certain kind of accrual of elements or of complaints or whatever it's going to be. And I think of even a writer like Bernhard, the Austrian. That stuff is incredibly funny because it builds in these insane ways. It's basically characters reiterating the same bitter complaints over and over and over and then inverting them and twisting them and letting them contradict each other to a point that there's, you know, a kind of a comic explosion. But also I want to get to the idea of laughing out loud. Sometimes I think the deepest laughs are kind of inner tremors that maybe other people won't even notice, but there's something kind of volcanic going on inside. So I can't remember too many times that I've really burst out laughing out loud while reading something.
Sam, you're also a teacher of writing at Columbia University. When you are reading the work of your students or talking about the craft of fiction with them, is humor an area you get into at all or not so much?
Only if the student wants to go into that area. I really don't bring my aesthetics into the classroom. I try to find out what people are trying to do and meet them there. And so if someone is trying to write a kind of multi-generational saga that doesn't really have room for much humor, that's fine with me. Let's try to make that work.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
Thank you.
That's Sam Lipsyte, who reviews House of Holes, A Book of Raunch by Nicholson Baker on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So we've got a new poet laureate, Philip Levine. Is his stuff available so we can all read it?
Well, people are actually trying to read poetry, but they're not having much luck because Philip Levine's books are not out there and very plentiful. So what we're seeing right now is that people are trying to find his books. If you go onto Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, you're going to have to wait a few weeks to get a copy of one of his collections of poems.
He's a distinguished, much admired poet, has published many volumes. Does that mean they haven't been in print for a while? Or has the supply, because he's a poet, always been kind of small?
I think it's the latter. Naturally, his books are still in print because he, you know, has won a Pulitzer, a National Book Award. So his books are out there. It's just that sales for collections of poetry are generally small enough that bookstores don't necessarily keep a lot of them on hand. So Knopf, which is Mr. Levine's publisher, is scrambling right now to reprint as many copies as they can. They told me that they are expecting to meet demand in the next 10 days by the 22nd. So right now they're just trying to get as many copies as they can to bookstores and to online retailers so that they can strike while the iron is hot and meet all the demand for people who want to read his poetry.
Julie, I would imagine that for the poet who is granted this very important august office as poet laureate, and also for his or her publisher, this is a big moment. Is it something that's in the works? Do they get advance warning that Philip Levine is on the short list to be the poet laureate, so you might want to get ready and have the books there, or doesn't it work that way?
My understanding is that there is a very long list of nominees, so it's not really enough of a clue that the publishers of these poets have any idea who's going to be chosen. So it seems like Knopf wasn't really expecting this to happen, or maybe if they were hoping, they didn't jinx themselves by printing thousands of copies in advance.
Do we have any idea whether Mr. Levine's work will be available in Kindle editions, e-reader editions?
Well, there was a recent collection that came out earlier this year, and that is available in ebook form for the Kindle, for the Nook, for the iPad. But it seems like a lot of his older collections, his collection What Work Is, which won a National Book Award, and The Simple Truth, which won the Pulitzer Prize, are not available in ebook form. But I would not be surprised if Knopf was rushing right now to digitize those books.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Next, Deborah Solomon discusses the long correspondence between Georgia O'Keeffe and Alfred Stieglitz. Georgia O'Keeffe and Alfred Stieglitz were one of the most famous couples in various ways in the history of American art. There's an enormous new collection of their letters. It's called My Faraway One, Selected Letters of Georgia O'Keeffe and Alfred Stieglitz. Get ready for this. Volume 1, 1915 to 1933. It's reviewed for us by one of our favorite critics, important art historian and cultural critic, Deborah Solomon, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi, Sam. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. But then I haven't read 814 pages of letters sent by these two. Are they worth it?
It's not a book that you can fit in your pocketbook. It's massive. And I read it all. I do think a reviewer should read the book. So I did read all the letters. And they do, on the plus side, remind you that letters are probably the most vivid way to access the dead. It's just incredible. You do feel like you're sitting there with them as you read.
We think of the two of them together. We have a photograph of the two of them together. They made art history together.
Right.
What brought them apart? They were writing all these letters all the time. Where were they?
They were seldom together, actually. Their relationship began as a two-year correspondence, and they seemed to fare best when they were apart. Their relationship was very much a long-distance love affair, or what academics might call a romantic construct, an imaginative construct. It was based very much on lonely yearning and their fantasies of each other. To O'Keeffe, Stieglitz, of course, was a great protector and father figure who helped launch her career. And to Stieglitz, the young O'Keeffe represented a little girl, a fantasy of innocence that bore little relation to the reality.
And what, briefly, were their backgrounds? Where was she from and where was he from?
She was born in 1887 in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin.
A Midwesterner.
And what's very interesting, and I hope somebody writes about this at some point, when I'm here, I always think of all the things I didn't mention in my piece.
Mm.
Her father, of course, was Irish, which is why she had the name O'Keefe. But her mother was Hungarian, and Georgia O'Keefe, who was great-looking, has Hungarian eyes. She has these dark, raccoon-like eyes. And I think that's what made her so striking. There is Hungary in her face. Harry Houdini, another Hungarian who grew up in Wisconsin, had similar eyes, the darkly ringed eyes. Stieglitz was a Jew from New York who suffered from very serious depression. If he were alive today, he would no doubt be on Prozac, and we wouldn't have his photographs and all his great artistic achievements. He comes across in the letters as a very wounded, hounded, and haunted man. And that was hard to read. You feel very bad for him.
And he was older, right?
He was 23 years older. That's what you wanted to know. He was 23 years older than Georgia O'Keefe and married at the time they first started corresponding to some kind of heiress, of course. And they fell in love through their letters. And it went on for 2 years. So as you read along in the letters, a tremendous sense of suspense develops. You think, are they ever going to get together, or are they just going to keep writing to one another until their hands fall off?
So at that point, when the correspondence begins, was Stieglitz in New York and she out there?
She, at this point, was a teacher in Virginia. He was in New York City. She had been to his gallery. His gallery, of course, 291 at 291 Fifth Avenue, was one of the legendary places of American art. It was really colossal. It was the gallery that tried to sort of modernize American art and Americanize modern art. And he showed many of the first wave of abstract artists in this country, like Arthur Dove, Marston Hartley, people who he believed could bring modernism to this country. And O'Keefe fit in with that program. She was a modernist. She was an abstract artist, or at least semi-abstract. And it kind of fit in with what he was doing. It was related to the other artists at the gallery in the sense that it was abstract, but not purely abstract in the European sense. What set American abstraction apart is that it was based on nature.
Mm.
A lot of hills, a lot of land. And O'Keefe saw herself very much as a natural, an American natural, somebody very close to nature, and acted as if, you know, all she had to do was practically touch a flower and the sap would travel into her and then somehow be transported to a canvas. She acted as if she had a very direct relationship to nature in her work.
And he had a genius for recognizing talent.
Right, right.
What about his own art? What about Stieglitz, the photographer? How important was he?
I think his great role was as an impresario, but a photography historian might disagree. He took the famous picture of the Flatiron Building, and he was a member of the pictorial school of photography, which means pretty effects. I mean, he wanted his photographs to look like paintings. He was probably more important, I think, in promoting modernism in this country than for his art. When people hear that she married Stieglitz, they say, oh, she did it just for her career. And I always find that comment problematic, because who else but Stieglitz could have understood her ambition and her work? And I think he offered her a level of sympathy and support that she could not have found anywhere else in the country. So, of course, she would be attracted to that. Who wouldn't?
Now, Deborah, at the end of the volume, we've gotten up to the year 1933. What's the relationship like at that point?
Already he's taken up with somebody else, sadly, after they married and after she finally moved to New York. He takes up with another acolyte, Dorothy Norman. O'Keefe pretty much goes off to New Mexico to get away from him. He's really tiresome to be around. He complains endlessly about his sinuses, his headaches, his feet, his itching scalp, as we know from his letters. And she goes off to New Mexico. They stay married until his death.
What are her letters like?
Her letters are unbelievably unrevealing, which is one of the frustrations of the book. She's somebody who seems to have had an innate distrust of language and was not that interested in saying things, unlike the writers who you know, she was a painter, who very much believed that words were not necessary as a form of communication. So she would say things to him in her letters like, I have nothing to write. And then she would write to him 4 hours later and say, I really can't think of anything to say. So the letters, in that sense, on her part, were a form of communion. When you write a letter, you think of a person, you form an imaginative bond with them. That's what the letters were to her. She does not lay out any art theories or principles or even any details of her struggles as an artist, which is unusual for artist letters. And I think that's one reason these probably come across as excessive. She really did not feel compelled to define herself through her letters, unlike so many other writers who, of course, use letters as a way to carve out a personality for themselves.
So Stieglitz complains and whines and fills his letters with all the details of his life. O'Keefe is much less communicative, as you say, but they kept writing to each other. So somehow this correspondence really did take on a
life of its own. It's very much that kind of correspondence, unlike Van Gogh's letters or Camille Pissarro's letters to his son Lucien, which are the classics of letters among artists. She doesn't try to define the artistic life at all. She is interested, rather, in affirming her imaginative connection to Stieglitz, her feeling of closeness to him by writing. And in that sense, these are real love letters as opposed to art letters.
Thanks so much, Deborah. That was Deborah Solomon, who this week reviews My Faraway One, Selected Letters of Georgia O'Keeffe and Alfred Stieglitz. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, once again, we have a new number one seller on the fiction list. It is called Cold Vengeance, and it is the latest thriller from Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. In general, as usual, there's kind of a lot of churn on the fiction list. I guess people are really plowing through their beach reading. George R.R. Martin is still at number two with A Dance with Dragons, but there are a bunch of new books, including a new book from Sherilyn Kenyon. It's called Retribution. It's at number four. And in general, there are only a handful of books on the fiction list that have been there for more than a couple weeks, and only two that are real long-distance runners. We've got Paula McLean's Paris Wife at number 14 in its 20th week on the list. And Stieg Larsson still hanging on at number 12 with The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. He has been on the list for 63 weeks, and maybe in the next couple of weeks I'll be able to report that he is gone.
Now, Nicholson Baker has been getting lots of press for House of Holes, and he's reviewed on our cover. Is he on the list?
Not yet. I think it's too early for his sales to show up. This reflects sales ending August 6th. I think it's a good bet he will pop up next week. As you know, sex sells. And also, he has something of a track record as a writer of bestsellers, at least for a literary writer. He clocked 1 week at the very bottom of the list back in 2008 with Human Smoke, his kind of very angry, pacifist, revisionist history of World War II. And back in the halcyon days of 1992, remember those? He spent 12 weeks on the list with Vox, of course, his infamous phone sex novel. Phone sex, that seems so quaint now.
What about nonfiction?
Totally different story over here. Not a lot of new titles. July and August are not really good months for big new nonfiction titles, so I think we will have to wait until September to see some new books over there. J.C. Dugard, still at number one with her memoir, A Stolen Life, followed by Laura Hillenbrand, Unbroken, and Eric Larson in The Garden of Beasts. That sort of batting order seems to be set in stone these days. Some kind of interesting titles that are still selling really strongly. SEAL Team 6 is at number 7 in its 13th week. You probably recall that that hit the list right around the time that the SEALs nailed Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. And as you probably also remember, this week they suffered a big blow. That helicopter that was down in the deadliest day in Afghanistan so far killed some 24 SEALs. So sadly, that will probably also prompt some curiosity into just what those guys are all about. Also want to give a little shout out for the neuroscientist David Eagleman. His quite interesting book, Incognito, about the sort of mysteries of our unconscious mind, is still on the list in its fourth week. It is at number 10. Not bad for something serious.
He's a favorite of yours.
A little bit, yeah. I like that brain stuff.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.